What was one of the things that was so wonderful about Mundelein, both of the students as well as the faculty like me, is that you know, we had all our fights, but it was a learning community. And so when I refer to that first year particularly, because the strike took place, I believe, in the spring of 70. Yeah, the spring of 70, where I'd only been there a few months, and again, I looked. You take your Bill Hills and your Mike Fortunes and your Russ Bardas and all these people who were mature adults. And I was, you know, not only young, but even younger looking. Mm-hmm. And so what the value of that was that there was, I mean, many people in academics, I mean, I think the people that I like, and sort of, they believe in the value of discourse, the value of intellectual debate, okay? And yet in many places in our society, in our politics, in many cases even our universities, there is a real paucity of real debate. You know, people are as cowardly there as they are in other places. So to have this full-fledged kind of like debate, students and faculty, should we do this? Should we have a strike? Wait a second, if we have a strike, that's not fair to the ones who are going to graduate, or that's not fair to this. Well, but on the other hand, in a time like this when people are dying and they shouldn't be, we got to change the rules, you know. I mean, so it's just all those debates, and the campus was full of them. And I remember just all sorts of situations, including with tears of people just legitimately trying to struggle. And some of the students that I got to know and still are familiar with, Miriam Perga and some of these folks, this was it was part of their lives. So Nancy Zack, who was graduated in 70, who I'm still in touch with, was one of the leaders. We even think we had a spy on campus. There's some guy that was a big kind of, always trying to push the envelope, but I think many of us felt that he was really a setup trying to create a problem. But the campus was alive, and I would never say that, you know, all the things that were done were right, but it was a very dramatic time, and you know, many people look back at the 60s or some of these elements, so I just don't think they have a proper historical perspective. And sure, there was people, maybe went along the demonstrations because they just wanted to go along, you know, it was fun to do. But the funny thing about Mundelein is particularly the whole strike notion was a very legitimate debate. And it's hard with hindsight, you know, it's hard to know what's the right side. You know? I mean, you actually shut down a university more or less to accomplish your purpose, or is it better to keep things going? But the nice thing about Mundelein is that there were choices there, and there was debate, and there was angry and upset people. And there was just a lot of experiences like that, again, which was my first year there. So it was very, in fact, there was a very dramatic group, mostly Loyola students, that were very, very talented actors and actresses. Be a bigger thing. It was Mundelein today. And I remember about that time they were performing Viet Bach, which is an anti-war play. And one of the more interesting experiences for me, again, as a 24, 25-year-old kid, whatever I was, that sometime, I think in that spring, I think same spring of 70, apparently one of their cast members had to leave. So they asked me to join. They were doing performances at Old Orchard or Mill Run Theater or something for one final weekend. And I did. You know, I didn't have a clue. I was extremely uptight. Because these were very free-spirited juniors and seniors, you know. The hard thing for me is, since I was a 24-year-old single male with all these women around, I think what you needed to do is you put up these walls. I'm kind of contradicting partly what I'm saying, because I really believe you've got to be personal to, but you still have these walls. And so, you know, with my friends, I might let loose and be a character. But with students, you had these walls. And so at this time, being with this group, it actually was very free-spirited. And, participating in this play in which the men all had were only dressed to the waist, and it was a theater in the round, and so I had very few lines. The one line I had, I know, was profanity. But so it fit in with that whole experience, and it was an interesting experience. So anyway, that was going on. It simmered down after that, but it had lasting implications. In other words, that particular strike, you know, there was still repercussions from it, but I look at the positive sign that people struggled legitimately, honestly, with what to do. They all got through it one way or another, and I think most of them, I'd say probably most activists felt it was a valuable time in their life. As to some of those students who felt, hey, what the heck is going on? You're interfering with my, again, whether they'd look back with hindsight and say, well, it was legitimate intellectual discussion, or they just say, bunch of crap, I don't know. That was a very intriguing time.
Do you feel that the faculty and administration supported things like the strike and campus protests?
Well, I think, again, you always had a mixed bag there. But even those that I might have differed with or fought with or argued with, I respect them. And I was a young kid who was caught up in this stuff and more willing to rock the boat than others. For example, Sister Anne Ida Gannon, the wonderful president and prime mover. I'm sure Anne Ida. Well, my God, who was this crazy kid at times? You know what I mean? And we fought sometimes over the years over political things and over there. But you know, I respect her, and I hope that she respects me. And I think that's what I'd say about it, is that it was an open intellectual debate in which I give the school and I give the BBMs credit, because they were on the edge. Remember, as a group, they might have been, some might have been much more conservative philosophically or politically than others. Remember, this is a place, not only with all these things we've talked about going on, this is a place where they're coming out of habit. This is a place where they're standing forward on many things. The whole issue of choice. Remember, this was before Roe versus Wade. There were women seeking abortions, and there were faculty, including probably nuns, that were assisting. This was a place, right or wrong, this was a place where I think you just had a lot of people with humanitarian values committed to, education. So what I'm saying is, it doesn't matter whether somebody was right or wrong, or whether or not somebody was more liberal or conservative. And even though we fought about these things, there was respect that I really appreciate. Whether it was your more traditional sisters or the more progressive ones.
Let's switch gears for a second and talk about the weekend college.
Sure.
You were one of five faculty members that put together the original curriculum. What were some of the kind of guiding principles that you worked with when you were putting together that
curriculum? Well, it's kind of a similar things that we've said. I'm sure the others remember it all more. Part of it was curriculum. I just don't have the recall right now to go into detail, but it was a curriculum we thought was relevant for them. We're talking about a certain population. A population of people who are going back to school, mostly women but not all, who, let me put it like this, I always like this, I remember I read a book with this title in it, and it always struck me as who these, particularly the first couple of years of the weekend college. As we know, we're looking for people who, in many cases, had jobs, and in a sense, they had a hidden wound. Okay, the hidden wound was they didn't think they were as good as they should be, whether it internally or whatever, because they didn't have that college degree. Because it's easy to say, well, you're the same person, you used to have to finish all those coursework. But there was this hidden wound, which partly led to the, from tremendous energy and commitment that these students had. And they really, you know, compared to some of the, you know, 18-year-olds that, hey, I'm here because I gotta be here. You know, it was kind of intriguing thing. So it was partly geared knowing these people needed a lot in a short amount of time. They don't have a lot of time. They will not listen to a lot of irrelevant stories from faculty or others. They don't want to hear their classmates just bet. They want to study and learn. They want to, you know, different experience maybe when you're 36 and you've got a job and you've got kids, bam. So it was geared toward recognizing that to be successful in a weekend college, you had to do a lot on your own. A lot less spoon-fed, in other words, because you didn't have as much class time. So the bottom line is you had to arrange a curriculum where you could give them a certain amount and limited amount of time. There was a lot of debate over this, and yet they had to do more than the normal student would do because there's less class time. And it's jammed on, and besides, their worlds are they have less time than the average younger student anyway. And so again, it was the whole student we're looking at. So there was the whole advisory part. All the five of us had a very serious advisory role. And knowing, I think it's true in all life, and particularly in education, is these other, on the edge of academic, are so crucial. You know, the advisory relationship, how to help you with something, how to work out things. And it was just such an exciting experience. And in my case, and I was heading up, we had these different directions, I guess. I was, at some point, I remember it was right then or not, but headed up the community studies part of it, where we kind of linked some of the academic experiences together to try and integrate them. And just what faculty are always trying to do, and I fight over all the time. But working with these students who are so committed, and I just think of those the first couple of classes, just so wonderful and exciting, and then advising, I had some incredibly talented students. I lost touch with a lot of them, a little touch with some of them. In fact, I wish we had more. I mean, the sad thing about Mundelein becoming Loyola is I just think there's probably less interested in these kinds of reunions. You know, I'd love to see a Mandela reunion or a more weekend college reunion that are targeted to that. But so, again, it was the bottom line, I guess, to start the whole thing was, is that Mundelein had enrollment problems, like every small school at that time. And so by having enrollment problems, the powers that be had to say, okay, well, you folks over here, we may not always want to listen to you, but if you can come up with something, we'll listen now. See what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. And so we say, okay, here's a chance for you crazy folks. Okay, go ahead. And so that means an opportunity for us. Like I said, we were these people that were always plotting, is there a way that we can do some education experiment that works? And this was a very practical one. This was a financially successful one for the school because, you know, Mary Griffin was the primary researcher, and we knew that there had been this weekend college experience, but never weekend college in residence. And so that was partly the element that we added. And that adds to the whole advisory and, you know, the go ahead, in a sense, it's also kind of revolutionary with women, too, saying, because many of these women were married, leave hubby with the kids for the weekend, what the hell, what is this, let's have a little equity here, let's, bam, you've got to jam it into a weekend, you don't have a lot of time, so we'll add the residence part, because, why should you be spending hours going back and forth, Friday night class and home, So, bam, that was a very popular thing, it was just intriguing, too, because many of these were women with kids. So it was, again, it was a total experience. It was an educational summer experiment, partly because the school needed the enrollment. It fit perfectly with the times, too, because people wanted to move more quickly. Why should these talented people take 7 years to get through? Because, so you have to break down those barriers. Everybody has to do it this way. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Bull. If they can achieve the level of knowledge sufficient to someone justifiably getting a degree, why not let them do it in a different way if we believe they're learning? And I think we clearly believe that they did, at least most of them. So it was just very exciting. I think that hidden room thing, these people were hungry. They were hungry for the recognition. Many of them, frankly, were a lot more talented than most of the BAs I knew. But they had this wound, and they wanted to prove to themselves and others. And so it was great teaching them. It was great advising them. And, of course, they brought interest and experiences. So whether it's a business class or whatever class, you know, these are people that are out doing the stuff.
In your advisory role, did these issues of marriage and family, did they come up?
Oh, sure. In fact, one of the most interesting students in the first year I had was a woman, very talented writer. And I lost touch with her, but she went on to write some things after it's been published, who left her three kids, who left them. And in fact, I think one of her books or one of her essays she was working on at that time was, "What Do I Say to My Children as to Why I Had to Leave?" Okay? Of course, that was exceptional. But so there was just like someone in that first group. And then, yeah, lots of that whole issue. Yeah, I mean, it was because you still, at this time, we're still, how can I say, somewhat counterculture. There's still a little bit of that. In the sense that, it's not that it's gone, but there's always tension, you know, in terms of how close one can be, how far one can go and discussing things with that person. But I think many people at that time were right to discuss them. I didn't notice much inhibitiveness of the word. I didn't see many inhibitions with women who were dealing with the male faculty. I mean, because we had Dan, we had Bill, and I think all of us experienced, people, again, it's a whole thing. Like, not only how can I get through this, how do I learn this, how do I study that, but yeah, if there was things that affected them, that came up, and because it was that, it was an atmosphere of which that was okay. So yeah, I think there was a lot of that. That's why this was intriguing, because there's all these other social elements going on. 74, it didn't start in 74. 74, 75. The women's movement was beginning to pick up steam. Like I say, there were women that, because they would bring into it, about. And it was, there was a few men too, but the spouse having to take care of the kids while I'm here and complaining about it or whatever. So.
How would you describe the rapport between the students and the weekend college?
I think the students mean among themselves.
Among themselves. Was it different than the regular student body?
I just saw so many positive things. I'm sure there was negative. I think they built a lot of friendships. They were probably less interested in, at that age, they're less interested in, let's say, recognition or approval from their classmates. So they kind of take it easy. These people I like, I'll sit with and, have coffee with and talk about. I saw a lot of very good relationships develop, some of them lasting. I think they basically got along well because they had this collective goal. They wanted to learn and learn fast, and we're serious about it. I think because the point was you could befriend people, or you didn't have to. And some of it was very interesting because, again, not everyone was in residence. It was just intriguing to what it was in class sometimes, or the relevant, it was more the advising part. But you'd hear particularly these women talking about how, they were in a dorm last night and they went over to the local tavern here, and they came back and then had their 9 o'clock, and they called home. Just lots of stories about how, for one, they developed the camaraderie. So they could do that, or they didn't have to. They'd have their room and go sleep and do their work and be gone, and no one bothered them.
Some of the courses that you designed and taught, the movements in welfare capitalism, radicalism in the U.S.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, how did you see these relating to the bigger picture outside the classroom? What was your the impetus, I guess, behind it.
I think for all of us in faculty, is part of what you want to do is as long as you can give, where do you start? Nobody could ever teach all of American history, okay, or all of English history, or all of English 101. So you always want to have a certain set of principles, whatever the content is that you're trying to achieve. And so I think most of us like to vary things. And again, so a younger guy, in this case, who was looking for ways to teach the same subject in a way, the larger American historical experience, but in ways that maybe were left out sometimes, or maybe that I felt I could make more relevant. So radicalism, and here we are in the middle of the war, so there's all these interesting experiments in the U.S. Or welfare capitalism, where did that one go? I mean, some of these it's hard to, I mean, the good news, I mean, some people might say you're nuts, you know, or that you're tampering too much. Mm-hmm. But the more positive side is you're willing to put time into, let's say, playing with curriculum, playing with different ideas and books and what you may use, and you're trying to teach similar things. So, in other words, there's almost no such thing as you can't teach everything. You can teach. When I started away at History 1 and History 2, okay? And when you're doing that, you decide which things of all this history you're going to talk about in History 1 and 2. And part of what's going on those years is why, you know, women will say, well, wait a minute, we're not very much a part of History 1 and 2, or African Americans, or later Latinos. And so there's always this revisionism stuff going on, if you want to call it that. There are always different approaches. And so I think part of this was just, it was partly method, partly content. Let's look at some of the things that aren't discussed as much. Okay. Labor in American history. Welfare capitalism was kind of another way to look at more economic systems more carefully than we've had. And I think a lot of it reflects a desire on some of my part is to learn more by teaching it. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can study up on those things. Okay, well, let's study up on labor history. Now let's teach it. There was a lot of experimentation. I laugh about it. In fact, I still get a kick that I actually taught a religion course because I team taught a course called History of Evil, I think that was the title, with Bill Hill. Mm-hmm. Again, which is a, you know, obviously education experiments are not easy. You know, it's not an easy thing to team teach something. Because, you know, oh my God, my colleagues didn't know how much I don't know about anything. You know. Faculty are very weird that way. As much as they know or don't know, they always feel like they should know more. And oh my God, everyone's going to see how much I don't know. And that was a great experience. I got a kick out of the fact that I actually taught a course where religion credit was received. It was a jointly taught course.
Was the administration or the other faculty receptive to all these experimental ideas and sort of alluded to that?
Well, like I said before, I think I'm sure some of the faculty thought we were nuts, you know. But it was a supportive enough atmosphere. In other words, clearly, a lot of faculty might have said, "Oh my God, what's all up to with this experimental college?" Mm-hmm. Certainly, were thinking, "Well, you know, he seems to be concerned about his students, and they seem to like his class, and boy, that." City crisis thing seems to be working, and the weekend college seems to be really working. So, you know, you've always got, you may have personal differences, and you may have academic or, you know, ideological differences. And so I'm sure there's people that thought that, like I say, I mean, you know, from the strike, just that appearance, you know, that, maybe, you know, long hair and fraternizing with students more than some people would want. We had classes where we'd go over to Hamilton's, a local tavern over there, and we'd sit around and discuss things. And so, but I felt, again, the Mundelein culture, no matter how conservative one might be on a particular political, was a pretty open culture, somewhat live and let live. and you heard that some nagging here and there. But again, these are women that were constantly in flux, partly because the order had changed so much. You know, there's fewer nuns to go around, and they were experimenting. They were going out in the world. I mean, increasingly, some of their key players were leaving. I mean, Sister Catherine O'Brien, I think, is one of the people who thought, you know, she left the order. And Mary Griffin leaving the order. Yes.